This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his
and
ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
How about this weather?
I know, it is so much weather right now.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
I was considering staying home instead of dealing with all this weather.
No one can drive in this weather. As soon as weather comes, it's like people have never seen weather before.
Do you remember yesterday's weather? Compare that to today's weather. It's like, are we even living in the same weather?
And did you hear this morning? Record weather, and that's not even if you count weather.
Speaking of weather, did you see that hilarious video where animals react to weather? Whoops! Right into the weather.
Have you seen that crazy picture of the lady who opened up her door only to find weather?
Ugh, typical weather.
But even I have to admit, I don't mind the weather in this month. And yet, I'm already dreaming of the next weather. Of course, once it's weather, I'll probably start missing weather. Isn't that typical?
You know, one day it's weather, and the next day, bam, weather.
Used to be, whether it was weather or weather, we would say, well, weather, and just keep on at the weather. I guess that's where the saying comes from.
If you don't like the weather, weather.
Wow, weather. I know the feeling. That's a piece by Ryan Kantz from the New Yorker's Daily Shouts column. It was performed by Scirocco Dunlap and Christian Achimovich. And I'm David Remnick. Today on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we've got a special invitation for you. We're going to a very exclusive, very swank party at Mar-a-Lago, the resort in Palm Beach where Donald Trump played golf this winter and conducted affairs of state, possibly at the same time. That's later this hour. John Ronson is a journalist who's worked very productively on the weird side of the street. He's covered subjects that you think really can't exactly be true. He's written about conspiracy nuts who believe space alien lizards walk among us. He wrote about the Pentagon's experiments with psychic powers. And one book covers his years playing keyboards for a bandleader who performed in a giant papier-mâché head. Still, those things were true. John Ronson's first completely fictional project has just come out. He co-wrote the screenplay for a new movie called Okja with the director Bong Joon-ho. Joon-ho is from South Korea and is most known in the United States as the man behind the absolutely terrifying movie The Host, as well as Snowpiercer. But he's been making movies for over 20 years.
In my first meeting with Bong, he didn't want to tell me anything. He was very guarded. His idea had lived between him and his producer, Duho, and Tilda Swinton and Tilda's partner, the artist, Sandro Kopp. So the four of them had lived with this as a kind of secret for a couple of years. And then I was to be the fifth person brought into it.
And what was the secret?
That it was going to be a film about a giant pig the size of an elephant, and the pig gets kidnapped by an evil corporation run by Tilda Swinton, and the little girl the pig's best friend is a little girl called Mija, and Mija has to use her wiles to get her pig back.
I want your honest answer. When you first heard the secret, what the story was to be about, what was your reaction?
I said, I definitely want to be involved.
I'm all in.
Count me in.
Pigs or no pigs, this is not a movie that's like Babe. It's more like Upton Sinclair's Jungle in some way. Thematically.
Yeah, well, it has huge tonal shifts. It starts off as this kind of enchanting children's film of Mija and Oksha, you know, playing about in the mountains of North Korea. And then it becomes a kind of slapstick satire, I guess a little bit like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, with these hapless animal liberation front activists.
We have a detailed plan on how to rescue her from the event in New York City. We promise to bring her back to you. If our mission succeeds, we'll be able to shut down Miranda's Super Pig project completely.
And Tilda Swinton plays this kind of...
She's this evil CEO, Tilda Swinton.
10 years in planning, on the cusp of a product launch that will feed millions. And what happens? We get tangled up in this terrorism thing, and somehow we end up being the ones who look bad.
Is it based on any CEOs that we know?
Yeah. I gave a TED Talk in 2012 when my book, The Psychopath Test, came out. And when I was in the audience, Regina Duggan, who was the head of DARPA, came on stage. DARPA is the U.S. military unit that invents the experimental weapons. So she comes on stage, and it's full of scientists, but they build weapons. So she comes on stage wearing a black polo neck, like Steve Jobs, and is very poised and very graceful. And the first thing she says is, "You should be nice to nerds." And so we all, you know, sort of melt. And and then she brings out a hummingbird, a robot hummingbird that floats over the audience, and everyone's looking up and gasping, all these tech billionaires.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Wow.
And then it dawns on us, kind of later, that, you know, what are they going to do with this robot hummingbird? It's like, it's a drone that's going to kill people. And I thought that was extraordinary. And so I thought a lot about that with Tilda Swinton's character in Oakja, because the film starts with this wonderful set piece of Tilda giving this 6-minute kind of TED Talk where she's announcing her new endeavor. And it seems so lovely. It's so kind of, it's so woke. It's so Brooklyn. Yeah, what it actually is a livestock initiative to raise and kill magical pigs.
Our super pigs will not only be big and beautiful, they will also leave a minimal footprint on the environment, consume less feed, and produce less excretions. And most importantly, they need to taste good.
It's 2 days before the film's released, but I actually have access to the Advanced New Yorker review from one Anthony Lane, who concludes with the very short sentence, "Oakja is a pearl among swine." I'm telling you, it's a rave.
Excellent. And you know what? The reason why people like this film is because Bong was allowed free rein to be auteurist.
But this tells you a disastrous thing about movies today. Disastrous.
It really does. You know,
I have a friend who writes screenplays, and he says, "Look, I go to meeting after meeting after meeting. When it's about a film, the answer is no. I go to meeting after meeting after meeting with television, and sooner or later, the answer is yes. That the creative freedom in television is comparatively immense, and whereas with films, unless you're presenting a Marvel comic, a DC comic, a very, very conventional thing to get 15-year-olds in the seats, it's really difficult."
Yeah, unless it's a really low-budget film where you can still get it made. But you're right, I was getting these kind of reports back from when the screenplay, kind of fifth draft of the screenplay, was going around the studios. And it was all anxiety. Are you really going to shoot this slaughterhouse scene? Are you really going to have half the film in Korean? And
what's
so on.
The film without the slaughterhouse scene?
Ah, it's
flavorless. It's
I mean, I know I keep talking about slaughterhouse scene, but that's so representative of everything that's so wonderful about this film, because it's this, you know, it's this funny popcorn movie with slapstick and chase scenes. Then it becomes truly haunting and disturbing and very moving. And all of those things are the things that the studios, the big studios, would have cut out. You know, I went to a screening quite recently, and there's a scene towards the end which is so sad, and all around me in the cinema people were sobbing. It's the scene where Mija goes inside the slaughterhouse and is confronted with the reality. And as much as I love a movie like Linklater's Fast Food Nation, which I love very much, that's not a movie that makes you cry.
No, it's a polemical movie.
Yeah, and this is not a polemical movie.
Your most recent book, which I read, is amazing. It's called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and it's about all the instances of shaming, particularly on social media, with the very notable anecdote of that young woman who wrote a very, very bad joke about AIDS in Africa before going on a trip to Africa. And by the time she landed there, she'd become a pariah, an international pariah. And it seems to me that the debates it incited over free speech and social media, political correctness and all the rest, have only become more fervent since you published that book a couple of years ago. So how do you see your book now?
Well, the first great Twitter shaming was the Justine Sacco one, which was the one you allude to. Before that, I think what happened was we realized we had power. If a Daily Mail columnist, if some right-wing columnist wrote something racist or misogynistic, we could do something about it. We could shame that person, and we'd notice that the Daily Mail would lose advertising, or you know, these were like, you know, these felt like good times, like the egalitarian. And then we took it a little bit further. So if a company did
You say we, by the way.
Yeah, I was one of those people. Yeah. I remember, it's just a little thing, but I remember a gym called LA Fitness refused to cancel the membership of a pregnant woman. And we shamed LA Fitness and they immediately backtracked.
Right.
We thought, whoa, this is amazing. But then what happened was, like, we fell in love with it so much. We fell in love with writing wrongs so much that a day without a shaming felt like a day kind of picking our fingernails. And so we lowered our standards. And that's
so it was like a narcotic effect.
Yeah. We loved it. And then somebody like Justine Sacco came along who all she was actually doing, it was a terrible joke, but all she was actually trying to do was be like South Park or Randy Newman, tell a kind of a joke mocking her own privilege. And the joke was...
And it backfired in the most colossal way.
Most colossal way, while she was asleep on a plane. And the fact that she was asleep on a plane and oblivious to her destruction fueled people even further. And I just thought, whoa, if this was an actual trial... We are trying and convicting somebody before they even know it's a trial.
Do you follow Donald Trump's Twitter?
Yes. In fact, Donald Trump was one of the people who was shaming Justine Sacco that night. He was one of the people who piled onto her.
And what do you make of him? How do you read him, his Twitter personality?
Well, this is the thing. See, I think on Twitter, every side of us polluted the waters. We all polluted the waters. And then I think Donald Trump emerged from these polluted waters like a kind of mutant fish from the milieu that we all created. And it wasn't just the right doing it to the left. It was everyone.
You've also written about extremists. You wrote a book about extremists. And one of the subjects was someone who's now even better known, Alex Jones.
Yeah.
And Megyn Kelly just interviewed Alex Jones for network television. She was accused of giving him, quote unquote, giving him oxygen. What did you make of all that?
Well, I mean, so I should backtrack slightly. I gave Alex Jones probably his first interview. Back in the mid to late 90s, I wanted to sneak into this secret club in Northern California called Bohemian Grove, where conspiracy theorists think that's where the ruling elite have human sacrifices and so on. So,
right.
But I didn't want to go on my own because basically if I failed to get in, it would just be me sitting in a motel room in Northern California.
Not getting the story.
So I thought, what if I can go in? If I don't get in with Alex Jones. And I'd met Alex Jones a few months earlier.
How did you meet him? At a diner just over scrambled eggs?
No, I met him in front of a bonfire at David Koresh's church at Waco.
You get around.
I really do. I went to Waco with Randy Weaver, who from the Ruby Ridge tragedy. And when I was there, Alex Jones was personally rebuilding David Koresh's church, and he was only 26 years old, but he was so charismatic. I knew he was going to be something. So I asked Alex to come with me, and it became like a big story for him. He brought out a documentary called Dark Secrets Inside Bohemian Grove. I kind of forgot about Alex for several years, and then suddenly I'm at the gym, and Trump's giving a stump speech. And this was at the period when it was all so new and strange. I immediately plugged in my headphones to hear what crazy Trump, who's never going to be president,
had to say.
And it was somebody shouted from the audience, "Are you going to go back on the Alex Jones show?" And Trump went, "Alex Jones, nice guy." I couldn't believe it. I nearly fell off my elliptical. So
it's the title of your next book.
And anyway, the Megyn Kelly thing. So as you can probably tell from the people that I've interviewed over the years, I don't really believe in no platforming people. Because I feel like, you know, you'll always find people who don't deserve a platform. But if we start doing it all the time, it just becomes unlikable. People move away from us. So, but I do think that there's very limited appeal in doing what Megyn Kelly did to Alex Jones, which was just sit him down and talk to him for an hour. Because you can do one of two things with that. Alex Jones will basically walk all over you because he's so good at it. But that's not what happened with Megyn Kelly. Instead, every time it cut to Megyn Kelly, she was being very poised and like, "No, Alex, you're wrong. You're very, very wrong." And every time it cut back to Alex, he's like sweating and stammering. And
you think she got the best of him?
Well, I think they edited it.
The combination of writing about social media, conspiracy theories, and now we live in the age of Trump, what does it make you think about what's happened to us? Have we gone nuts in some way?
Yeah, all the worst people, when I say by worst, I suppose I mean the most extreme, the most trenchant people I've ever interviewed are in power now. Ian Paisley, the head of the Democratic Unionist Party in the United Kingdom, I spent time with him, who believed, you know, that the IRA are in league with the Pope to, you know, to secretly rule the world. And his right-hand man was ahead of the Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign. His party's now in alliance with the British Conservative Party. Alex Jones has White House credentials, and he's close to Trump.
What's your next project? You've just done something both fun and unusual and but also political, you're the film. Where do you propel yourself next?
I'm just finishing a project that's taken me the last year. It's called The Butterfly Effect, and it's another look inside the slaughterhouse, as I think my So You've Been Publicly Shamed book is, and Oakshire is. And this is about the adult industry. And the slaughterhouse in this case is the way that hundreds of millions of people now watch their porn for free on streaming services like Pornhub and don't think about the consequences. Like, nobody cares when music's being pirated, and this is porn, so like no one cares.
What are the consequences?
All the money's flowed from the San Fernando Valley, which is where the world's porn has been made all of these years, into the pockets of the tech giants. A porn star can't get a checking account because they're deemed unrespectable, whereas a tech giant who wants to create a streaming service to host pirated porn can get a $362 million loan from a hedge fund. The consequences are extraordinary. I'll give you two examples very quickly. One is pretty much every child in the world gets to learn about sex through Pornhub these days, 10, 11, 12 years old. So one of my stories is about a kid in Oklahoma with autism who was trying to impress a girl but didn't know how to do it because he's autistic. So he aped something that he heard in a porn movie, some dialogue, very disturbing dialogue that he heard in a porn movie, and texted it to her. And he's now on the sex offenders registry for 25 years. I'm going to counter that with an upbeat example, which is a lot of porn producers who don't make any money anymore because all the money's gone to the tech giants, have created a new industry in the valley. And it's the world of bespoke porn. They will make an entire porn film for one person to their most specific predilections. And I thought that was just fascinating. I've spent a lot of time in the world of bespoke porn lately because it's such an incredible window into people's inner lives, what films they would commission if they could commission like any porn film in the world.
God. John, you never cease to amaze, to entertain, and to capture our interest. I really appreciate your being here. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted to have come in. Thank you.
That was John Ronson. The film he co-wrote, Okja, is streaming now on Netflix. And his new podcast is called The Butterfly Effect. I'm David Remnick, and in a minute, we'll visit Mar-a-Lago, where the lobsters are, of course, gigantic, and the Trump brand Chardonnay flows freely.
It's a well-made wine. There's thought behind it. It doesn't have much depth.
It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Palm Beach is on a long, skinny island, a barrier island, about 70 miles up the coast from Miami. It's one of the wealthiest places in the country, a billionaire's paradise with crystal water, pristine sand, and 70-degree temperatures right in the middle of January. And for much of this past winter and spring, Palm Beach was the home of President Donald Trump. A unique aspect of this presidency, among many unique aspects, is the fact that the president owns a private club called Mar-a-Lago, and he lives there much of the time, and he conducts presidential business while mingling with members and dinner guests. And today, we're going in. A couple of months ago, The New Yorker's Lizzie Whitcomb traveled to Palm Beach along with Stephen Valentino from the Radio Hour.
Here comes a Bentley with the driver and passenger filming on their iPhones as they go.
Got a helicopter circling.
They started on this tiny island in the Lake Worth Lagoon, a bird sanctuary that's about as close as the public can get to Mar-a-Lago. That island became a gathering point for protesters and supporters, hoping that the president would just take a little notice of them.
Oh, I guess they're not stopping today.
So has he stopped before?
He has stopped before, several times. And apparently, I wasn't here, but the last time he stopped, he actually got out and called some supporters and brought them over to his home. They had Secret Service pick them up and bring them there. Amazing, totally amazing.
So was part of you hoping for that today?
We were, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But we understand. He's got another president with him. It's probably much too dangerous to stop. Wow, look at this. Look at this sight. Oh, my God.
So we were down there while Trump was hosting the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. And here's the thing, although some of the most powerful people in the world live for part of the year in Palm Beach, they're not always thrilled about being the center of the universe every time the president is in town.
Unless you're a member at Mar-a-Lago.
Talk about bikers for Trump. These are the police bikers.
Donald Trump bought the estate in 1985 and eventually turned it into a private club. And it has a unique position in Palm Beach culture. There have been lawsuits and letters to the editor over the club, but it's also been the site of a lot of social and charity functions, and basically everyone in the island has been there at some point. And there seems to be a lot of tension about where exactly it fits in.
We don't really think about class dynamics within the 1%, but Palm Beach is one of these places that preserves the distinction between old guard and new money. And Mar-a-Lago is definitely new money. But if you want to meet the old guard, the Palm Beach Flower Show is the place to be.
Hey, Gazy, how are you?
We met Mary Chapman Webster, the lady to know at the Palm Beach Flower Show, and her husband, Joe, who owns a golf course.
Anyway, every year for a flower show, we always do a centerpiece. And last time we did a Volkswagen covered in moss that was sort of regurgitating flowers, which is really quite fabulous. Uh-huh. I'll send you a picture of it.
When you get dressed up for an event in Palm Beach, one thing to keep in mind is you should not be afraid of color.
There's a lot of pastel dresses, silk jackets, and diamond-encrusted brooches.
It looks like a gazebo, and it's covered in beautiful, bright orange lilies. Now I understand why I'm seeing so much orange tonight.
Yes.
Okay. It's all making sense.
Hey, here comes my husband. Come on in.
Interviewing the lady.
We're interviewing the lady of the hour.
Yeah.
You know what he says every time I win anything? He goes, you know, she never thanks the little people.
And every year at this time, she turns our apartment into a botanical Hiroshima.
Not true.
Wow, a lot of sacrifices have to be made for an event like this.
Anyway.
How would you describe Palm Beach in the age of Trump? People are talking about it a lot more. It's kind of become the center of the world. I mean, how would you...
I don't think for the people that live here, it changes, because there's really... You know, a lot of people that are very much under the radar, that are here all the time, that you're never going to see in the paper or anywhere. And then there are people that love to have their pictures taken, and Trump works for them. And
right.
But I don't think, other than the kind of a two-edged sword, I would say, the burden of him being here is tough on the airports, because everybody has to shut down.
And how would you describe the people at this party? Is it the Mar-a-Lago crowd?
Not at all.
How are they different?
Well, I don't... I just... She said, is this
Palm Beach
Mar-a-Lago crowd? I said, probably zero.
You want me to be real blunt?
Yeah, tell us.
This is more... No, this is a very old Palm Beach crowd. These are people whose either they or their families have lived here probably for two generations. The Mar-a-Lago crowd is a much more recent... to Palm Beach. They are more...
At that point, she puts her hand over the microphone and says, it's newer money.
This is old guard.
Right. And so what about, would you say politically, was this kind of a Trump train?
The town would be 50-50.
And how would you describe the tenor of the support among the pro-Trump group? Are they passionate Trump train fans?
It was a lot of very powerful, quiet money.
And how does quiet money feel about Trump?
They backed him.
And are they worshipful about his business skills? I mean, are they really impressed by him?
Not worshipful about anything. Most of them are as successful as he is. So, you know, they just wanted the country on a different path.
Yeah.
And Trump's a different path.
Now, you can find a lot of quiet conservative money among the residents of Palm Beach, but you can also find liberals.
Were you at the Garden Flower Show last night?
God, no, I didn't. I boycotted.
No, I didn't boycott it.
I had lots of house guests, and I didn't need to go.
We connected with Democratic activists Bruce McAllister and Polly Reid, poolside.
So can you describe, Trump and Palm Beach have a long history.
Yes.
And of course, many people in the world have, are just finding out about Palm Beach now. I mean, you know, it's well known to some people, but, yeah. but.
It's a funny thing. Palm Beach's attitude towards Donald Trump was formed in many ways many years ago when he was first here and bought Mar-a-Lago and erected a huge flagpole like the ones you see outside used car lots and on the grounds in violation of zoning code and defied the town council to do anything about it. And
among many other things, he was in constant litigation with the town of Palm Beach.
This was one of them.
One of them.
And so they sued, and they settled. Donald Trump moved the flagpole back and shortened it. And it just so happens I wrote a letter to the Shiny Sheet, which they published.
The Shiny Sheet is what they call the local paper, the Palm Beach Daily News.
About... Please Don't Eat the Daisies. It's a book by...
Right.
What's her name?
Well, it was Walter Kerr's wife, wasn't it?
Deborah Kerr?
No, it was Walter Kerr, the columnist's wife, I think, who wrote
Deborah,
it.
Deborah, I think.
No, Deborah Kerr is the movie star.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter who
Dolores
wrote the book.
Maybe.
What's this book? I don't
anyway,
know.
Anyway, so it's the theme was, what do you do with teenagers? You know, you can't think of every single thing to tell them not to do. Because... They'll go out. Who would think, don't eat the daisies? I mean, who would think? But that's what they do.
Oh, I got to get this.
So I said, look, it's like you can't tell Donald Trump to abide by every single rule that he might break because he'll think of rules to break that you can't imagine. Just realize that we have a giant teenager in our midst and acclimate yourself to that.
So his antics or actions as president are for you on a continuum with the flagpole and all that?
Yes. I mean, he is a continuum. An erratic one, a volatile one, but a continuum.
Jean Kerr, and she was the wife of Walter Kerr, the
right.
theater critic for right. the Times or the Herald Tribune, maybe yeah. it was back then.
Yeah, right. right.
Can you kind of elaborate about who was he as a character in the imagination of people in Palm Beach? Like, who...
We sort of averted our eyes.
But now you can't ignore him anymore.
Right. No, now you can't ignore him because you can't, you know, the North Bridge has two lanes, the Middle Bridge is crowded forever, and the Southern Bridge is about to be redone and has Mar-a-Lago. So, I mean, you know, you have to choose. I never ever chose when I was leaving this place. Now I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's Thursday, and he's coming tomorrow. I'm not going to be able to go to the vegetable store down on Dixie, because I always go down to the Spanish vegetable store. I can't go down there until I better go down there early this morning, because I will never get back.
And that's probably the biggest impact, traffic.
Pro-Trump or anti-Trump, everyone in Palm Beach can agree on that. The traffic is a bummer.
Traffic is safe to talk about.
Traffic
that's
and
why.
Weather.
Yeah.
I walked through the Garden Club thing the other day because I was working all day on the setup. And they're arguing over, talking about the putting burlap on the tables or something they couldn't find. And I'm thinking, I said, 7,000 Syrian children have just been wounded and we're worried about this. And this person said, we just can't worry about all those Syrians. They just don't want it to come up. It just doesn't. Wanted to come up. I mean, I keep thinking of the bigger picture in life. And the bigger picture in life is my little problems are just nothing compared to what is going on in the rest of the world.
So Polly is going around town speaking truth.
Yeah, well, probably, and they don't want to hear it. No, he just says, then I'm just a nutcase, you know.
I wanted to get into Mar-a-Lago, the center of the action. So I got us an invite to a charity event in the Grand Ballroom.
And we were told that President Trump himself was going to show up.
This is not an uncommon thing at Mar-a-Lago. Trump roams the halls and pops in on events. You may remember a few months ago when North Korea tested a missile and Trump dealt with the crisis on the club's dining terrace, surrounded by guests.
Impressive.
So we'd heard a lot about the heightened security when Trump is in town. But getting into Mar-a-Lago wasn't really that difficult. after going through a metal detector and being checked out by the Secret Service to make sure we were on the list, we walked up a very long red carpet that had been laid across a plush putting green.
There's a pool and water features and oversized stone parrots. And of course, the bulletproof presidential limos were on display.
I'm okay for right now, thank you.
Some well-dressed waiters were passing around Mar-a-Lago's beloved lollipop lamb chops with some very bright green jelly.
The first guest we met was Hayden Hosford, a chic blonde in a flapper-style dress with metallic fringe, and her husband, Dr. Herbert Gould, with a plate full of lobster.
Now, Herbert came down from New York.
We were going to speak with you, Herbert.
Okay, well, he is a doctor, and Herbert...
So Herbert is wearing a pinstripe
Ungaro
suit.
Bought it for him.
She knows exactly what it is. And a very dapper pocket square. And he is very elegant, kind of white.
A horse tie.
A horsey tie.
We're both horsemen.
Hermes. Horse tie.
Horse tie.
We're both fox hunters.
We're here.
Fox hunters?
Yeah.
Well, we don't ride anymore because the bones aren't mending so quickly at our age.
Herbert is an ophthalmologist. Hayden is the heiress to a dynamite fortune. They've been coming to Donald Trump's private club for a long time.
How was Mar-a-Lago, what was the reputation of Mar-a-Lago when it became a club versus the other ones? Like, what was it?
I thought it was so elegant and so beautiful. I loved it. There were people, old Palm Beachers that raised eyebrows.
Old Palm Beachers. But you know that crowd, obviously.
But I think it's fantastic. Trump built this. This ballroom was not part of the original Mar-a-Lago. And I was here opening night. And the chandeliers were supposed to come down and go back up for effect, and they didn't work. And the kitchen didn't, the food was all cold. This was opening night for the first ball here, which I think was Leukemia. And we were all excited. And there were some glitches. I loved it anyway.
So you were a believer.
I knew that it would get straightened out very quickly because Mr. Trump is a perfectionist.
The old Palm Beachers who were initially kind of snooty about when he bought Mar-a-Lago and so forth,
Some have come around. Some have come around, and some are still raising the eyebrows.
What, really?
I don't care. I love it here. I think it's the most elegant place, and I've been to palaces all over. I've had dinner with Princess Anne at Buckingham Palace. I've been in the palace in Monaco. I've been in a lot of palaces. And to me, this is my favorite palace.
Really?
But it's the best.
Now, we should point out that Mar-a-Lago does, in fact, look like a palace. This is full Louis XIV repro opulence. Gold is everywhere, in the chairs, in the rococo ceiling, around the mirrors, in the drapes. And even though it's just one ballroom, there are enough crystal chandeliers for three ballrooms. And of course, the marble floors are inlaid with the Trump crest.
What can you say about Mar-a-Lago with Trump as president in the Trump presidential area?
Well, it's a little more difficult to get here. There's a little more security.
It's kind of like the center of the world, though, in some ways.
Nobody expected when he became president that he would consider this, because it's a club, that this would become the winter White House.
Yeah.
We assumed he would be going to Camp David, and Trump would have none of that. Too rustic for him. He wants his luxury and his gold leaf and his glitz.
So do you know people who are trying to be here on nights when he's around so that they can rub shoulders with the president?
I have thousands of pictures that people have taken with me talking to him at events over the years.
Wow.
And since he's become president, I got the pictures and put them in frames. I told him a long time ago when he first announced he was going to run, I said to him, "You got my vote." And he said, "I better."
I'm sure you've been to all the other clubs. How does the atmosphere here compare to other places?
It's so much better. It's so much better. He likes people that are smart and bright and interesting. Some of the old Palm Beach clubs are really obnoxious.
Like, what would the atmosphere be when you walk in there? You feel like people are judging you?
Or? Not name the club, but my girlfriend married a Jewish boy, and they told her, don't worry, you can still come to the club, just don't bring your husband.
So
a lot of that goes on in Palm Beach. This club, Trump is not interested in what religion you are. That doesn't matter. He wants you to love golf. He wants you to love luxury. He wants you to have class, intelligence, charm. It's a whole different vetting system.
And be able to pay the fee.
You have to have a little...
That's the weird thing about Mar-a-Lago. It's actually less exclusive and snooty than the other clubs.
Trump is a man of the people as long as the people can cough up $200,000 plus annual dues of $14,000.
That gets you the use of the dining areas, pool, spa, beach club, tennis courts, croquet lawn.
And these days, it also gets you a chance to rub shoulders with the President of the United States.
But we were just at a party in the ballroom, so we hit the buffet table.
So can you just describe what just happened?
A chef in a white chef's hat just expertly pulled a lobster out of a pot and dismembered it and took it all out of the shell. And we got a little pots of hot drawn butter from a silver tank of some kind. My life will be in your keeping. This is like clearly a Secret Service guy there. He's got the earpiece. Oh my gosh, look at these ladies. Holy crap.
Can you describe what they're wearing?
I would say it's all kind of variations on Donatella Versace.
Isn't that Donatella Versace?
Is that actually Donatella Versace?
That's either Donatella Versace or a very good impression of Donatella Versace.
Wow. Yeah, you might be right. I'm going to ask her.
It wasn't Donatella Versace.
So it's a nice fancy party, but somewhere in the building, the most powerful man in the free world was attending to affairs of state.
Or maybe he's still in the sauna. We just didn't know.
While we were hoping for him to show, a waiter came around with bottles of Trump wine.
Do you mind if I record you tasting the Trump Chardonnay?
Very good idea. Now, let me, first before I taste, I will give you my credentials. I am the founder of the Physicians Wine Appreciation Society. I'm a Grand Officier of the Chevalier du Tastevin, which is a Burgundian society. I am a Commandeur of the Commanderie de Bordeaux, which is a Bordeaux society. And I have a wine cellar that I've been collecting ever since I got out of my residency in White Plains. So I think I know a little bit about wine. Therefore, I am about to taste Trump's Chardonnay, the great wine grape of Burgundy, actually. The greatest white wines in the world, I think, are Burgundian Chardonnays, and they're also the most expensive. Here we go. Are you waiting? Hold your breath. First, the bouquet. Very pleasant, very flowery, most acceptable. And now we're gonna look for the taste, and that's much more complicated. Here it goes. Remarkably well balanced.
Do you feel like this Chardonnay reflects the president?
Well, let me taste it again. You put me on another course of this discovery.
So Dr. Herbert Gould reflected on how Trump wine is like Trump the man.
It's a well-made wine. There's thought behind it. It's it doesn't have much depth. but it has a little excitement. It's very fresh. So it's somewhat superficial in its character, but absolutely delightful in the drinking. Will that do it?
So will you be getting another glass?
If they give it to me, I'll gladly accept. I will not refuse a glass of Trump's Chardonnay. But I think with time, it will improve.
Like any good wine.
And like any good man.
So we're still waiting for Trump. At this point, we get pulled outside to talk to Paulette Cooper Noble, author of the weekly column Pet Set People.
Let me tell you about dogs in Palm Beach. First of all, I have a column called Pet Set People. What I do is I interview the famous, the rich, the high society people in Palm Beach if they have a dog or a cat. This is a town of little white fluffy dogs and people who dress them and people who say that their dog is an emotional support dog and take them every place, in carriages, in carts. They walk them down Worth Avenue.
Were you are you a member at Mar-a-Lago? But you've been quite a lot.
Oh yes, this year I went to 6 balls. Oh, this is funny. Okay. Let us put it this way. My husband and I are not fans of Donald Trump. I don't know if I should have that in public because it's dangerous.
He is famously not an animal lover, and I think Louis Pope tried to change that.
Yeah, he did, and Paul will give you a comment on that, but I'll just tell you that my favorite protest sign is somebody had a big sign that said, "He doesn't even have a dog." And I thought that was wonderful.
It's arranged for a wonderful, wonderful, what kind of a doodle is it? A labradoodle?
Yes.
A beautiful dog named Patton for him. And he turned it down because he just thinks he's too busy and his household's too busy for it. So she kept the dog for herself, and she's in love with this labradoodle. His name is Patton, and he is a glorious animal.
Remember, honey, we interviewed, you heard about the Trumpettes?
Yeah.
All right. She had a dog named Trump because they're very close. And I did a story on her, and I wrote about
The head of the Trumpettes. It was Tony Holtz.
And her dog was named Trump.
Right.
So recently, I realized that this would be really good for my column. I get a photo of, a dog named Trump and a whole. This is before Lois.
Right.
And it turned out that Trump had died, so.
Trump has died.
So went my story.
When did he die?
I think she was a year or so ago. She didn't tell me. So there was that story was gone. It would have been so cute.
It was the best column ever.
It would have been a dog named Trump, and I could have been. But I try not to get controversial.
So Donald Trump never dropped by, as he promised the hostess that he would.
But we learned later that he had been a little busy.
We have attacked Syria, you know.
I'm sorry?
We have attacked Syria.
We have?
Yes. Just before dinner, he had his NSC meeting right here, and they attacked Syria. 50 Tomahawk missiles to take out the places where they are suspected chemical weapons.
NSC meeting in this building?
Right, while this is going on.
And how do you feel about being?
I'm stunned.
Wow. Holy crap.
That's kind of, yeah.
While we were talking about the human cost of war.
He was ordering 50 Tomahawk missiles to strike Syria.
There you are.
Mail.
9:42, right?
Do you support that, or how do you feel about it?
No, I don't talk politics.
And there you have it, folks. an evening at Mar-a-Lago, Palm Beach, Florida. That was The New Yorker's Lizzie Widdicombe along with the Radio Hour's Stephen Valentino. And this is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
I'm David Remnick. Welcome back to The New Yorker Radio Hour. Next week on the show, we've got interviews and live performances with two giants of American song, Lucinda Williams and James Taylor.
The idea of that song is it was sort of like one note samba. It's just that da na da 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 da, and then the changes,
the harmony
move, underneath it, and that's a very Brazilian, very Jobim thing to do. So I was hugely impressed by that stuff. And
unbelievable you, impossible me, fool who fell out of the family tree, fellow. Found the philosopher's stone deep in the ground like a dinosaur bone. Who fell into you at a quarter to two with a tear in your eye for the 4th of July.
James Taylor. Don't miss it. Now we're going to close the show today with a terrific poet. The poet laureate of the United States as of a couple of weeks ago, Tracy K. Smith. The first piece of hers we published in The New Yorker not long ago was a poem about Levon Helm of the band, which really warmed my heart. And today Tracy is going to take us on a little journey near her home into the woods.
We are at my home in Princeton, New Jersey right now, and we're heading into what is known as the common land or the common wood that sits in this neighborhood, which is called the Gray Farm neighborhood. And that's my dog, who's jealous that she's not coming. And it leads out to Lake Carnegie. We're walking along like a bed of bark, this path, and there's some tree stumps that have been lined up to create like a little guide to the path. To the right, we see some of the houses that look out onto the lake. You can see the bridge up ahead, the cars going into town off to the left. One of our neighbors planted, I think, thousands of daffodil bulbs, so we'll pass those. Some people have what my kids call bamboo forests. You'll see some neighbors up here have bamboo at the back of their property, and it's just kind of this open space. I loved being a young writer in New York and having my community of people and our sense of a hunger and excitement. And then I had kids and my father died. So we left New York City and moved here. And I had a little bit of, I was anticipating having heartbreak about leaving Brooklyn, where I'd lived for so long and was so happy. And then I came here and I was like, oh my God, this is the real world. Like, there are these trees that are just electrically green, and I feel like something in me has changed as a result. Like my, I don't know, I feel like the trees are doing more than just giving oxygen. I think they're these old souls that kind of console in different ways. And so there's something beautiful about this as a backdrop of what feels like a new beginning, or the beginning of what comes after youth. And maybe I feel sort of consoled by the fact that the landscape just keeps going despite all of the things that we do. That's really been the really most beautiful surprise of being here, how much silence and green space has fed the inner silence that I think most writers are seeking. I had a teacher once who, Linda Gregg, the poet Linda Gregg, who said, if you are suffering from writer's block, it's really just anxiety that's keeping you from being quiet. If you're quiet, after about 15 minutes, your mind is imaginative enough to come up with an idea to prevent boredom. And I feel it's so true. In my 20s, I couldn't write. I had so much anxiety about what people were saying, what my classmates and teachers were saying about what I was writing, that I just kind of stopped for about 9 months, which really hurt. And my strategy at that time was to take a photography class, just to be doing something creative and learning to look at things through that lens. And I think it helped bring me back to the page, because I recognized something I hadn't quite articulated to myself before, which was that an image can do such amazing lyrical work, and it can free you from the need to make statements and explain. If you can just describe, a feeling can emerge that the reader can't help but participate in. And before that, I thought poems were a series of wise statements that someone who had discovered things laid out one after another. And so I was, no wonder I had writer's block. I could figure out maybe one thing that seemed genuinely interesting, and then a couple of other things that were in imitation of a wise person, and then I couldn't get past that. The first thing I want to look for is something that has to do with a bird or something natural. I feel like there's an effortless sense of clarity that I can locate in some of those types of sources. Yeah, sometimes what I know is, look, there's a deer. Several. Oh, wow. No matter how many times you see one, you still get that same feeling of, wow, lucky. I'm sorry, guys, I'm bothering you. Wow, I can't believe we made it back the way we came in. This almost never happens to me when I'm by myself.
The poet Tracy K. Smith. You can find her poems in The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. And that's it for today. Join us next week for James Taylor and Lucinda Williams. And until then, keep up with us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio. And have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Michael Lee Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Jessica Henderson, and Eric Malinsky. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.